Hello and welcome to this week's JAMA podcast. This is Philip Greenland, senior editor at JAMA and professor of preventive medicine and cardiology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. I'm speaking today with Dr. Thomas Gaziano from Harvard Medical School, Harvard School of Public Health, and the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And we'll be discussing two articles that appear in JAMA this week regarding the ongoing question of cholesterol, guidance and appropriate use about statins in healthy people for prevention of cardiovascular disease. And Dr. Gaziano's paper is on cost-effectiveness of 10-year risk thresholds for statin use. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Phil.
So let's jump right in. Why did you choose to study this particular question and maybe particularly relate it to the 2013 cholesterol guidelines?
Well, first of all, cardiovascular disease is the number one killer worldwide, including the United States. And as a cardiologist predominantly interested in prevention, I've been particularly concerned with how we can reduce this health burden, in particular how our guidelines are developed in helping these efforts. And I've been critical of our guidelines in the past because I think they've become confusing or complicated, making them harder for everyday providers to follow. In fact, in 2009, I wrote an editorial for JAMA stating that the previous guidelines, the ATP3 or the third version of the National Cholesterol Education Program guidelines, were too complicated and that we needed to create a new way of determining eligibility. And when the new guidelines came out at the end of 2013 that had been promulgated by the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology, I felt that they made a significant step to simplify them. However, the guidelines were controversial in a couple areas. One, they lowered the risk thresholds for which people would be eligible for treatment, which would mean an increasing number of people may be eligible for treatment, up to 12 million. And second, whether the risk calculators used was a good tool to predict risk. Well, we were primarily interested on that first sort of controversy on what threshold or risk would be appropriate for treatment.
Can you tell us about the study and particularly what were the main findings in the study?
Just first of all, from the perspective of the individual patient, we knew that trials had shown that statins reduced the risk of cardiovascular events anywhere from 20 to 40%, depending on the dose or amount of cholesterol reduction, even among low-risk individuals. However, there are side effects in a small subset, including myalgias and even rare events of rhabdomyolysis. And likely, in more recent studies have shown that there was a small increased risk of developing diabetes. So we wanted to see where the equipoise, or as you want to say, the balance between these significant benefits of a major killer and these risks, albeit small, of side effects. At what point are those risks potentially outweighed by the benefits? The second perspective is on the cost. Statins have gone from costing anywhere between $1 to $2,000 per year when they first came out and were patent protected to less than $100 per year in their generic formulation. So with an order of magnitude of difference in price, we want to see how low the threshold could go and where it remained cost effective.
So tell us what the findings were.
Well, we found that the threshold of 7.5%, which is, quote, the controversial lower target than the previous 10% in the previous guidelines, is highly cost effective, meaning that we could spend up to $37,000 per quality adjusted life year gained at that threshold. And this was quite robust in our findings. Second, that the threshold could even be as low as 3% and be cost effective and save an additional 161,000 cardiovascular events. At a willingness to pay of, say, $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year, there's a 99% chance that the threshold would be lower than 7.5%.
So that sounds kind of like economics to me. Can you put that in the perspective of what it means to doctors treating patients and what it means to patients?
It means that the side effects, albeit some of them be concerning, like rhabdomyolysis or diabetes, are so small and so rare that an individual can still have significant benefits, even at relatively low risk for heart disease, by taking the statins and still outweigh those small risks associated with taking the medication. Look, in the parlance, there are no free lunches, and with any medication, there are potential risks and side effects, but nearly 30 years of data for statins has shown them to be extremely safe medication and extremely efficacious, so that it would take a fairly low risk of a patient before those benefits start to be outweighed by the small levels of side effects. For physicians, they can feel comfortable that if a patient is interested in lowering their risk and feels comfortable taking the medications, that this is not only a safe alternative, but also something that would be relatively cost-effective for them.
So let me ask you kind of a tougher question that wasn't exactly addressed by your study. if it's really potentially cost-effective to treat with statins down to a very low level of risk, like, say, 3% in 10 years, and if a lot of criticism of the new guideline is that the calculator overestimates risk, would you be willing to say that even if there's some error, it might still allow for that error in the margin between 3% and 7.5%?
Yes. And in fact, if you just, from the patient and the provider who are less concerned about cost and just talk about their own health, we looked even further, excluding costs themselves, but just where's the equipoise in terms of the risk and the benefits on the health effects of the statins. And that actually is lower than even the 3%. It's down to 1% to 2%, where the very small risk, you know, 1 in 10,000 or so rhabdomyolysis, even a 9% increase of developing diabetes, and a relatively small number of people develop myalgias, you have to be at extremely low risk before the risk of statins outweighs their significant profound benefits. And so from just the health of the patient, 1% is far below the 7.5% threshold, 7 times a difference that both patients and providers can be quite comfortable that even if the risk calculator overestimates the risk by a very small amount, it's not in the order of 7-fold. And so that the 7.5 is quite a safe threshold from a patient safety perspective.
That sounds like this could really be a practice-changing paper, that this could really allow physicians to feel much more confident about recommending preventive statin therapy for a broader selection of patients.
I think so. And I think, again, it goes back to the guidelines themselves. I think there have been a couple different things that have affected clinicians in initiating treatment with the use of statins or other medications. One is the guidelines are too complex for them to figure out who is treated. Remember, in the ATP3 guidelines, it was anyone between a 10 to 20% risk, but also had 3 different levels of cholesterol, who didn't have these other things. Now it's basically really focusing down, can you measure this risk? If they're above a certain threshold, initiate treatment. If not, you know, withhold, discuss other lifestyle interventions for that patient and reassess at a later time. So I think the combination that the guidelines themselves, I think, are easier to follow, as well as the fact that we show that the safety overall is fairly strong in these medications, that both providers and patients can feel comfortable with this decision.
Can I ask you one other question, which is related to the second paper that we have in this same issue of JAMA, which comes from the Framingham Offspring Study, and they tested the calculator from the AHA-ACC 2013 guideline against the previous, the ATP3 calculator, and they found that the new calculator and the new guideline detects more people who are destined to develop an event, and it also detects more people with high coronary calcium. So my take on that paper was that it seems to give even further reassurance that the new guideline might be very appropriate. Do you have any comments about that?
Yes, I think so, and I think that we are very much interested in similar questions, approaching it from a slightly different way. If you look at their paper, they describe, you know, even how to compare the ATP guidelines. It's much more complicated compared to the ASCVD risk calculator. And they confirm that, you know, having an easier calculator that looks at overall risk, not just risk plus LDL levels, is a more sensitive way of determining the risk of a population than just the cholesterol alone plus or minus the other risk. And this whole idea that we've moved from looking at overall risk as being the most important and very sensitive way to detect it, and the fact that this risk calculator itself is good at detecting those people at risk, it is broader than the original Framingham risk equation, including the ERIC and other populations, suggesting it is quite generalizable.
So, Tom, this is obviously a model, and models are always sensitive to some of the inputs in the model. Can you tell us what were the factors that the model was most sensitive to and what you think that means?
Sure. Our results were sensitive to the question around whether a patient dislikes, or as in the common cost-effectiveness terminology, has disutility from taking of the medication itself. In that scenario, an average from a previous study said that on a scale of 0 to 1, they have about a 1 in 1,000 reduction in their utility or their happiness when they have to take a medication. And when we look at the sensitivity around that, that didn't seem to be very significant. But if we increased that dislike of taking a medication, then the cost effectiveness went up. We went to sort of the farthest range of some of the older studies. Then it was around the 7.5 or 10% risk that cost effectiveness changed. And so This means that it's very important for physicians and patients to have a discussion about their aversion to medications. And if there's somebody who's particularly known to be non-compliant or does not like taking medications, then perhaps that's a point of discussion for particularly those people that are maybe below the 7.5% risk. It may not be worthwhile for them if they have such a strong dislike for taking medications. The other area where there was some sensitivity was around the diabetes risk. Not very sensitive to the expected range from the major meta-analysis that was published by the Oxford group. However, only at the extreme values, if you had a greater than 50% increased risk of developing diabetes, would this risk threshold not be below 7.5%. But for most studies, that's only about a 10% increased risk. So that had to be a fivefold difference than what the average estimate is.
So what you're saying is that at about 7.5% risk and above, physicians should push patients a little bit more toward going on a statin because it's not only effective, it's cost effective. And even if they're fairly averse to taking medication, it might still be worthwhile. But below that, let's say, cut point, physician might be willing to cave in a little bit if the patient is averse to taking medication. Does that sound right to you?
That's exactly right. And so I would agree, it'd be consistent with the guidelines. It's actually the opposite in many cases. Patients come in saying, I'd like to do anything I can to lower my risk. And then the physician could be safe and say, well, you know, we think even below the 7.5% threshold, you could do it. However, we all have some patients that say, look, I just would rather do this through lifestyle changes. I don't like taking medications. I don't even like taking vitamins, anything. And so let me just do this through lifestyle. If it's below 7.5%, then you could say, okay, I think that means reasonable, but let's be serious about those lifestyle changes. And if we don't reduce our risk, let's relook at this question in a year or two.
So I can anticipate that some doctors are going to read your paper and they're going to say, boy, this looks really mathematical to me. And this is all about, you know, some model that works for populations and might be good for policy. But how does it relate to my individual patient? How do you respond to the doctor who says this is just all, you know, a model and it doesn't really matter to my individual patient?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's often the case we get around a lot of different treatments. How does my patient differ from the clinical trial even? Is that trial population relevant to my patient here in front of me? First of all, let me step back and just on the one question in general. Our model is a population that's made up of individual patients that we follow and are able to follow their outcomes and events and make sure that they are consistent with the representative population of the United States and the results, including their cardiovascular events and their deaths. Clinicians are increasingly, with changes in capitated budgets, balancing needs of our individual patients versus the population as a whole. Interesting, this type of thinking that you raise is usually used when the guidelines ask us to withhold a treatment. For example, antibiotics for someone with a virus to protect against not only wasted resources, but potential increase in drug resistance, or in the denial of an expensive test. In this scenario, we are perhaps advocating for perhaps more treatment for individuals who, albeit are at only, say, a moderate risk, but for whom there's great benefit with few side effects. And here, though, I think the individual preference are important. As we mentioned before, if a patient has a strong aversion to taking pills, then perhaps they shouldn't do that. If they're waiting for the clinical trial, comparing these two guidelines, it won't happen. And so we are always faced with a decision when the patient's in front of us, and we have to look to the best available evidence. Sometimes it's a trial. Sometimes it's case control or other information. Sometimes it's a modeling paper to do that. But this should give them reassurance that 7.5% is well above a threshold that makes it worthwhile for them if they have some concern about validity around the specific point of 7.5%.
That really summarizes very, very well what your paper's about and what the other paper's about. And the new guideline seems to be potent, seems to be cost-effective, even at a lower threshold than what was originally recommended, and that even if there's some error in the calculator, there's enough margin of safety in the cost-effectiveness that doctors can feel comfortable recommending statins to a broader group of people. I think that's a potentially practice-changing set of findings. Tom, I'd like to thank you for taking part in this JAMA author interview. Once again, this is Philip Greenland with JAMA. For more podcasts, visit us online at jama.com.